we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
The first thing that comes to mind is that if it was a military-grade poison, then people would, of course, have died on the spot. Russia has no such substances. We destroyed all our chemical weapons as monitored by international inspectors. I think anyone with common sense understands that it is nonsense for Russia to do such things before the presidential election and the Football World Cup.
But when I look at the evidence, I mean, the people from Porton Down, the laboratory.
So they have the samples.
They do, and they were absolutely categorical. I mean, I asked the guy myself. I said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "There's no doubt."
Well, it's been a supersized election spanning 11 time zones across 17 million square kilometers of territory. Vladimir Putin has secured a fourth term as the Russian president by a landslide margin.
It is very important to stay unified, my dear people. It is very important to win over even those who might have voted for different candidates. We need this unity to move forward.
It is no longer tenable for Western governments to claim that their argument is with the Russian government and not the Russian people. It is no longer tenable because in 2018, popular support in Russia for the country's president, Vladimir Putin, reflected in an election that saw him returned to power with 77% of the vote on a 67% turnout, is now undeniable. It proves that on the back of the assault unleashed against Russia by the British government and its media echo chamber, or, as is perhaps more accurate, on the back of the assault unleashed on Russia by the British media and its government echo chamber, support for Putin in the country has only solidified and increased. Putin's popularity in Russia parallels the popularity that was enjoyed by US President Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1930s and 1940s. As with his counterpart in Moscow, FDR served four terms in office, and just as FDR came to power in the US at a time of severe economic crisis and with seismic geopolitical events threatening America's security, Putin came to power at the height of Russia's Great Depression in the late 1990s, and likewise with seismic geopolitical events posing a threat to Russia's security. Hopefully, by now, you're starting to catch my drift. According to US scholar and Russia expert Stephen Cohen, what befell Russia in the 1990s amounted to the worst economic and social catastrophe ever suffered by a major nation in peacetime. Russia, he writes, sank into a corrosive economic depression greater than that of the American 1930s. And evidence for Cohen's assertion is provided by Canadian journalist Naomi Klein, who reveals in her peerless work Shock Doctrine that in 1989, according to statistics supplied by the World Bank, 2 million people in Russia were living in poverty. That is to say, under $4 a day. By 1998, this number had increased to a gargantuan 74 million. With this in mind, the reason for Vladimir Putin's popularity in Russia is self-evident. Under his tenure, the free market calamity inflicted on the country was arrested, whereupon economic sanity and stability was restored, and the oligarchs, crooks, and mafia gangs that had been running rampant were faced down, arrested, and or chased out of the country. And many of them ended up in London, by the way, seeking and receiving sanctuary along with their ill-gotten gains. And not only has Putin cleaned house at home, he has successfully restored Russia's standing as a strong and independent nation internationally, turning it from a country that had genuflected at the feet of Washington under Yeltsin into one that refuses to accept Washington's right to rule the world. It is for this and no other reason that the demonization of Russia and its president has long assumed the character of a religion in the West, wherever crazed neocons roam. For such people, Russia can only ever be a vanquished enemy or a deadly enemy that needs to be vanquished. Therein lies the problem, and thereby lies the real threat to the security of people living in the West. On the back of the poisoning of former Russian military intelligence officer and MI6 agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury, England, the demonization of Russia in the UK has intensified to the point where it has embraced 19th century Russophobic tropes dredged from a swamp of British jingoism. Penetrate the obfuscation and the meta-narrative is clear. The old unipolar world is dying and the new multipolar world struggles to be born. I'm John White and this is Hard Facts. Well, sadly, all too sadly, in the face of this rolling thunder of neo-McCarthyism that has been unleashed across the UK's media and political landscape, dissenting voices have been all too few. But of those dissenting voices, there is no doubt that the most powerful and passionate has been that of George Galloway, who joins me now. George, welcome to the show.
Well, that was a cut-out-and-keep introduction, I must say. That was Alistair Cook. That was amongst the best broadcasting introductions I've ever heard. And you really don't need me because you've said it all. But the scale of the assault that Russia is under in Britain is probably not entirely understood internationally. And maybe I can supplement that a little bit, because I'm one of those who, because I'm reasonably prominent in media, have had the opportunity to try and make the kind of case that you have just made. And the response has been as ferocious as at any time in the run-up to the Iraq war. One is treated as if one is either mad or bad or both. One is treated as if the arguments that one is making are so far out of the orbit of propriety in Britain that one is made to feel virtually like a criminal. There have been times in the media in the last few days that I have felt that it was me that was being accused of poisoning these people in the streets of Salisbury. It's been a quite almost unprecedented assault. Now, if I feel that way, how does the leader of the opposition, who, by the way, has not put up nearly as much opposition as I think he should have, but because he even asked intelligent questions about the government's narrative, has been literally painted as a Kremlin stooge. I mean literally. With Russian hats photoshopped onto his head. They stopped short, just short, of putting a Lenin badge on his coat. They pictured him, photoshopped him outside the Kremlin, where I doubt he's ever even stood as a tourist. It has been incredible. This is worse than the 1950s.
And even more incredibly, George, the incident you referred to where Jeremy Corbyn's image was photoshopped and superimposed onto the Kremlin or in front of the Kremlin to make the connection between Jeremy Corbyn and Vladimir Putin. It was not on a far-right news channel or website. It was on the BBC. That is the British Broadcasting Corporation. That is the British state broadcaster. And it was straight from the enemy of the people playbook. And like yourself, I have been utterly appalled. It has been absolutely frightening to behold. But you touched on, I think, the key difference that helps us understand where we are and the level of this ferocity between Iraq and between today. Because if you recall, being a prominent leader in the anti-war movement then, the ironclad consensus with regard to the danger or the supposed danger that Saddam posed, the threat that Iraq's supposed WMD posed to British security, the 45 minutes in which this WMD could be weaponized and unleashed against British targets in Cyprus. It took months to build this ironclad consensus, George. I think we could date it back from the infamous meeting between Bush and Blair at Bush's Crawford Ranch in Texas. And there was a slow drip because there was no RT back then. There was no Sputnik. There was no social media. And so they had the time to build this ironclad consensus across the media and within the political class. But now with RT and Sputnik and social media, they don't have this time. And this is why I think there has been so ferocious in just a few weeks, where anyone who dares dissent, and you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn, but also yourself. Afshin Ratansi, a high-profiled presenter with RT, was on BBC Question Time, and he was hung out to dry. Anyone who dares dissent has been treated as an enemy of the people. Your thoughts on that dissimilarity, George? Do you agree with that?
I do indeed, and it's more difficult for them now, but they have done it with a rapidity which has taken my breath away. Within hours, they had their narrative underway, which makes you think and conclude, I think, that they intended all along to do that. It wasn't just an act of spontaneity. But by the time Parliament had assembled on the Monday, the Pavlov's dogs could not have moved with such synchronicity as the British parliamentarians did. Corbyn asked a few intelligent questions that it was his duty as the leader of the opposition to ask, but the rest of the parliament, almost to a man and woman, was a Pavlovian reaction to the mere assertion by the Prime Minister. Back in the Iraq times, at least Tony Blair tried to make a case based on evidence that turned out to be false, but at least he felt he had to produce some evidence. The assertions of Theresa May are nothing more than that. Simple assertions, not a scintilla, jot or tittle of evidence, of fact, has been placed in front of people. As I said on my own radio show this morning, there has not even been an all points alert made by the authorities as to who we should be looking out for as the perpetrators of this crime. Is it a white man, a black man, a Slavic man, a man with red hair or a blonde hair, black hair? Is he big? Is he fat? Is he small? Is he thin? We've no idea. We could be sitting next to them on the omnibus. No one has even tried to make a case. Not a CCTV image has been released of the people being sought, or of the victims for that matter. Not a hospital bulletin has been issued. Not a police statement has been issued. It is mere assertion by the state that this event has happened as they described it, and the culprit is Russia as they have named it. But the fact that chills the blood is that so many people in the media, who are paid presumably to have inquiring minds, have been so ready, even after Iraq, even after the Chilcot inquiry, so ready to blindly accept the assertion of a state leader, Theresa May, based on what Theresa May says are intelligence findings. You would have thought that the Iraq war had never happened, that the Chilcot report had never been written.
Indeed, it seems like when they are not trying to get us to forget the last war, they are trying to prepare us for the next war. We're coming up to the break, George. After the break, I'd like to get into the significance of the formulation of a type developed by Russia. You're listening to George Galloway. This is Hard Facts. Don't touch that dial.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down in the company of George Galloway. We are discussing the fallout of the Skripal case, the continuing fallout, and the sui generis rolling thunder of neo-McCarthyism that has been unleashed across the UK's political and media landscape as a consequence. George, I mentioned that you were one of the most prominent and passionate dissenting voices in the face of this neo-McCarthyism that's been unleashed, alongside, I think, former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, and Peter Hitchens, the right-wing blogger. You three have formed, I think, something of a triumvirate in this regard. But the extraction from the government's narrative of a type developed by Russia when describing the nerve agent that was allegedly used to poison Mr. Skripal and his daughter, and is subsequently being used by NATO in its official narrative or its official response to this case and the EU. What is the significance of this formulation of a type developed by Russia?
Well, it is an unusual triumvirate, you're right. The ambassador, the right-wing columnist, and me, and even more extraordinarily, Craig Murray and I both come from a small Scottish city called Dundee. But the phrase, which is now being clung to like a limpet of a type developed by Russia, has a very serious and specific origin. This is the only formulation that the scientists at Porton Down, Britain's own germ warfare centre, were prepared to sign up to. They at least have the professional integrity so far of refusing to be allowed to be used as saying that Russia is the source of this material, that Russia is the perpetrator of this material. They will not sign up to that, at least so far. But they are saying that this is a chemical formula, a nerve gas formula that is of a type developed by Russia. That in itself actually could be contested, but let's leave that to one side for a moment. Craig Murray, the former ambassador, came up with the brilliant analogy. Penicillin is an antibiotic of a type developed by Scotland. Vodka is an alcoholic drink of a type developed by Russia, but it's now made in Warrington. And penicillin is made in many places in the world. It actually is a meaningless phrase because if it was developed by Russia, and as I say, there's some doubt in the OPCW, the treaty organization that governs the issue of chemical weapons, that this was ever actually produced rather than being just a formula which was published in a book in the United States 10 years ago, the knowledge that could produce this material has, of course, spread everywhere in the world. You don't even have to buy the book. You can Google it and find the formula behind this so-called Novichok that they are claiming was used in Salisbury. And that's, if I may digress for a moment, even if what they are saying happened in Salisbury actually did happen, because we don't even have any evidence for that. We haven't even seen a picture of the victims in the hospital. We haven't seen a statement from the hospital authorities. We haven't seen the local police chief give us a briefing on what they say happened. There are all kinds of strange things around this case, unprecedented, in my opinion, in a major criminal investigation.
The lack of motive combined with the stampede to judgment, combined with the viciousness and venom of the attacks on anyone who dares dissent, we discussed that. It comes together to form a giant, suppurating, stinking rat. I smell a giant rat in all this. And as you've said many times, and rightly, and I have said, Russia has a capability and capacity to carry out a crime of this kind, but whether it has the stupidity, that is the question. This gentleman, Sergei Skripal, was given a government pardon in 2010 as part of the spy swap. He was no longer a threat to Russia's security. Everyone's speculating. I try and not get into speculation about who could have been responsible. It could have been many people. The question is, was Russia responsible? And this feeds into Russia's election, George, because the attempt to make a distinction between the Russian people and the Russian government, that has now been blown out of the water by this election result, has it not?
Yes, because it's not only the 77% that President Putin got. If you add the 11% that the Communist Party candidate got, you're climbing up to almost 9 out of 10 Russian voters rejecting the neoliberal script dictated by the West, rejecting the idea that Russia should be just another vassal state of the West, that Russia should recover its national dignity, prestige, standing in the world. Almost 9 out of 10 voters are now identified by that, with that. And that means that there is no dichotomy between the president and the people. If you go to war with the president, you're going to war with the people. And so people should be very much more circumspect in the way that they are talking. In particular, the British Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, daily ramps up this conflict and personalizes it more and more. He has openly stated that the president of the Russian Federation is personally responsible for ordering this crime to be carried out. Again, without offering a scintilla of evidence. And if I may add one point, he claimed yesterday that the British government has had evidence for the last decade that Russia was maintaining a secret chemical weapons program, producing these Novichoks and training agents in the use of them for political assassination. Either that is a brazen lie, in which case Boris Johnson's not fit to wear the jersey that he wears, or it's a dereliction of duty so serious that he actually ought to be on trial for it. Because if he knew, if the British state knew that Russia was in brazen defiance of its treaty obligations under the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare Treaty, if he knew that, why didn't he raise it with the OPCW? Why didn't he tell us? Why didn't the British state tell us that Russia was actually breaking the legal obligations that it had undertaken? Now, of those two possible explanations, I'm afraid I believe the first, that Boris Johnson is openly lying about Russia. And that's a very dangerous thing to do.
Well, it's a very dangerous thing to do, George, because on the 15th anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq this month, it should be borne in mind that Russia in 2018 is not Iraq after 13 years of sanctions in 2003, nor is Russia in 2018 Libya in 2011, whose armed forces were weak relative to those of the NATO countries that descended upon it. Russia in 2018 is the largest country and most populous country in Europe, with an army comprising 800,000 troops, equipped with some of the most modern weaponry in the world today. Whence this ineffable arrogance and recklessness on the part of these people, George? And just let me caveat that, because people accuse me as being associated with Russian media of pledging an allegiance with Russia rather than my own country. My solidarity in this issue, and I think I speak for you in this, George, is not with Russia. My solidarity is with the thousands of young working class British men who will be sent off to war in the event that conflict erupts, and who will come back dead or maimed.
My loyalty is to the truth, because I've been here before. I stood where Jeremy Corbyn was standing on Wednesday and Monday, being assailed by a parliament that didn't want to hear the truth. And I've seen the consequences of the burning of the truth in the run-up to and the aftermath, all those bloody years of aftermath of the Iraq war. And I will not accept any government's assertion. I want to see the facts, the truth, on which they are basing these assertions. It's not party political. I was a Labour Member of Parliament when I was demanding that from Tony Blair. I'm not a supporter of the Conservative Party, but if they were telling the truth, I'd want to hear it. I'd want to listen to it. But just asserting something as a fact without giving me any of the bases on which that fact is adduced is simply unacceptable, because I believe in the truth and I believe in fighting for it, and that's what I'm doing.
Well said. Do you believe that this feral media, I think it's common knowledge, George, I think it's accepted, certainly is believed by myself, that the British mainstream media is the most feral and aggressive in the West? What role would you suggest they have played in this? Because I get the strong feeling that this government, which is already mired in crisis over Brexit, has somewhat been bounced into taking this strong position against Russia by the media, which rushed to judgment the day, the very minute that this incident occurred on March 4th.
Well, I agreed with your opening statement. I've made it myself, though not quite as well as you did, that I used to say we had a government and we had a media echo chamber, but in fact we've got a media and a governmental, parliamentary, democratic echo chamber. I think that the media have driven this, and I don't quite understand it, because it doesn't actually fit in with the theoretical appreciation of politics that I grew up with. I always imagined that the media were the tail and the state was the dog. Now I'm beginning to wonder as to who is the tail and who is the dog. The media are certainly out of control in Britain, and they want to close down any part of the media, like the one we're talking on now, like the RT channel that I work for with my program by the same name, Sputnik. They're trying to close down anybody, any broadcasting organization, any individual who dissents from the prevailing orthodoxy. And there, I mean, there are some people that I fear for their personal safety in this regard. Because if you are telling the people that the leader of the opposition is a traitor to the country, well, what happens to traitors? What happens to traitors in any country? It's a very frightening atmosphere that we've got now in Britain.
And Jeremy Corbyn is probably the most accessible party political leader of any we've ever had. Certainly in my lifetime, he's with the people, he's accessible, he's out and about in the country, he takes public transport. I agree, this is a very, very frightening time with regards to the personal safety of Jeremy Corbyn. This has gone beyond politics. This is redolent, I think, of Germany in the 1930s. I don't think I'm overstating that, George.
Well, there are certainly aspects of it which are definitely comparable. There are other aspects which are comparable to the run-up to the First World War in 1914. And in a sense, it's therefore just as well that Russia is militarily so powerful and could dispense of any military attack by Britain so comparatively easily, even if at vast cost to the peoples of both countries.
Well, you were listening there to the voice of George Galloway on the ongoing crisis regarding the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury, England, on March 4th. We also discussed the impact of the Russian election results, which I maintain, and George agrees, that was significantly influenced by the unending neo-McCarthyite assault that has been unleashed in the UK and throughout the West on the back of the Sergei Skripal crisis, for which there is absolutely not one piece of concrete evidence produced thus far to point the finger at Russia justifiably. And when the EU comes together and issues a statement asking Russia for proof of innocence, then you know that we are through the looking glass, because the cornerstone of any justice system worthy of the name is that the burden of proof lies with the accuser and not with the accused. Have these people learned no lessons 15 years after the war in Iraq, the hell that was unleashed on the Iraqi people, leaving 1 million dead, and out of which ISIS was born, giving us all the issues regarding international terrorism that we've been dealing with since, leading to the collapse of Iraqi society? How many millions suffered as a result of what was an imperialist war, one of the most vicious, indeed the most vicious and devastating since the war on Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s. And when I think and look back on that period, I'm reminded of the words, the sage words of Frantz Fanon, who writes, and I quote, "Imperialism leaves behind germs of rot which we must clinically detect and remove from our land, but from our minds as well." You've been listening to George Galloway. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.